The following is an encore presentation of the World Vision Report.
This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Join us today for stories about the world's most vulnerable people and those who make a difference in their lives. On this week's show, some women in Ghana use creams to lighten their skin, but they're finding it's harmful to their health. And Kelly Carroll gets a kick from helping others down on their luck.
I'm like really just revved up now, you know, because I just can't wait to see her face.
Plus, a writer from Ohio decides to find out where his clothes come from.
It kind of all started with one t-shirt. It was orange, had a tattoo from Fantasy Island on it. It said, "Follow me to my tropical paradise."
He did, and he ended up in Honduras. That story and more just ahead. Welcome to the World Vision Report. You may be one of those who spends hours in the sun trying to get a tan. That's in spite of warnings about skin cancer. But in India and Africa, people with dark skin sometimes do just the opposite, try to make their skin lighter. That's also a health risk. From Accra, Ghana, Michelle Betts looks at the cost of lightening your skin.
Here in one of Accra's sprawling markets, where the smell of dried fish permeates everything, you don't have to walk far before you spot a vendor selling products to lighten skin.
We have Numa, this one.
We have a product called Numa. You spread it on your body. We have another product called Fair White.
That's Rosemary Tetty. She's showing me just some of the bleaching creams available in her shop.
Maxitone Light, you want to tone the body.
And we have Maxitone. They're all bleaching lotions and creams.
All these products are marketed to produce what's known here as cocoa skin, a term that means light skin. Bleaching has been going on in Ghana for decades. Some blame the legacy of colonialism and the prostitutes who started the practice because they wanted to attract whites. But as time went on, bleaching became more common. Fair skin became synonymous with beauty. No one knows exactly how many women bleach, but the practice is widespread. Further into the market, I chat with some women selling dry goods. Most of them, at some time or another, have bleached their skin, some since they were teenagers. Gifty Afreya is one of them. She says she's been using bleaching creams for more than 30 years.
We use it to attract.
We use it to become attractive. That's the main reason.
Sometimes I
bleach when I see my face is becoming too black, so I will still be attractive.
Vic Odako leaves her stall to join us. She wants to be like me, she tells me. Fair, white. And that, Vic says, is why she bleached for some 30 years. But she adds, it doesn't always work. She says she stopped bleaching because she ended up with multicolored blotches on her face, the result of exposing bleached skin to the sun. It's a permanent side effect, but it's far from the worst one. Dr. Herbert Addo is a dermatologist in Accra. He sees firsthand the devastating effects of bleaching. Particularly damaging, Addo says, are creams containing steroids, which are illegal here, but still widely available.
With the corticosteroids, the effect of prolonged use appear. This comes in the form of thinning of the skin, so opportunistic infections appear.
The other common bleaching chemical is something called hydroquinone, which strips away the skin's pigmentation. Both the steroids and hydroquinone leave the skin more vulnerable to infections and UV rays.
If you go on bleaching long enough, you convert your dark skin to a Caucasian type of skin, and the prolonged sunlight exposure could make you susceptible to carcinoma like in anybody else in the sun, heavily sunny areas.
Dr. Addo recounts the story of an educated woman in her 40s who'd been bleaching with hydroquinone since her teens.
She just started developing ulcer on the side of the neck, and this was not healing. We went ahead and biopsied it.
The biopsy showed the woman had cancer.
Within 2 years, she died with metastasis.
So bleaching can actually kill you?
Oh, it can.
Dr. Addo says as long as popular figures like sports stars and singers lighten their skin, it will be difficult to stop the practice.
Unless those in the higher class start avoiding this practice to be difficult to educate the lower, those in the lower class.
Back at the market, I passed one woman who was curious about my microphone.
What are you doing?
I'm doing a story on bleaching.
They'll soon bleed that.
Yeah.
So you have medicine for it?
Huh?
You have medicine for it.
The woman asked me if I had medicine. She was looking for a cure for her discolored face. But not everyone thinks whiter is better. Joyce was selling hair extensions, hair creams, and wigs. I was sure she'd be selling bleaching creams as well. I was wrong.
I'm not interested in bleaching. Because I'm black. So I don't want to be white. Because I'm not a white lady. So I don't want to be white.
But for the foreseeable future, it seems that few women will share Joyce's attitude. For the World Vision Report, I'm Michelle Betts in Accra, Ghana.
Now, our globe at a glance. In a traditional African village, the elders are trusted to resolve conflict in the community. Now there's a new humanitarian alliance which plans to do the same thing on a larger scale. Made up of statesmen, Nobel laureates, and development experts, the elders will work behind the scenes to solve some of the world's major problems, like hunger, poverty, and AIDS. They'll work independently without any ties to government. South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu chairs the council. Among the other famous faces at the table, Nelson Mandela, President Jimmy Carter, and Kofi Annan, former UN Secretary General. The alliance is the brainchild of British entrepreneur Richard Branson and rock star Peter Gabriel. Together, they raised $18 million to fund the project. While skeptics are doubtful the group will have much leverage with world leaders, others are hopeful that these global elders will succeed at solving some very pressing problems. And that's our globe at a glance. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. You're listening to the World Vision Report. The Council of Elders will work on a grand scale to help those in need, but many individuals without much power are making a difference too. Kelly Carroll is one of them. Correspondent Kathy Duchamp brings us this profile from Kent, Washington.
We're heading out. We're going to load up the truck and go have some fun, because that's really what it's all about, is just some fun.
Kelly Carroll runs a charity out of her home. It's called Our Place of Refuge and is funded by private donations. Her mission, to spread random acts of kindness to people in need. She might pay a late utility bill. Other times she gives a supermarket gift card to a hungry family. This day, Carroll is making a surprise visit, delivering food, clothing, and furniture to a woman with cancer.
So you're getting totally excited right
yes,
now.
Yes, I'm like really just revved up now, you know, because I just can't wait to see her face. And, you know, I mean, it's just like that impact. It's just that you only have one moment to capture it, you know, when somebody's looking like, what in the world is going on?
To understand why Carroll does what she does, you have to go back a couple decades. Carroll was a teen growing up poor in Seattle's central area. She was angry and felt ignored by her mom, so she ran away. She spent a few nights on the streets.
I seen a lot of people, you know, sleeping in garbage cans and digging, and I just thought to myself, is this where I really want to be? But I couldn't go back.
So she called her grandmother from a payphone.
And I said, I don't have nowhere to go. And she said, stay right there. Don't move. I'm on my way. She said, you know, when I don't have nothing else to offer you, I may not have money, I may not have anything else, but I'm always have a place for you to stay, a roof over your head, and some kind words.
Carroll pays forward her grandmother's generosity in her work today. We're now at the home of the woman with cancer, Lisa Wachowski. A small entourage of volunteers accompanies Carroll.
On behalf of myself and an anonymous donor, we paid up your life insurance for 6 months.
My life insurance?
Your life insurance for 6 months. I paid all your utilities for 2 months. On behalf of IKEA, we got brand new furniture for you, beds. And these are just volunteers who wanted to just kind of take some of those tears away and give you a chance to just laugh and smile.
A couple weeks before this, doctors told Wachowski there was nothing more they can do for her bone cancer. Her husband Jacob is out of work with a knee injury. The couple has two small children.
I don't have words to describe it. It's just amazing that some stranger would do that for us because we're going through hard times. I truly didn't believe that there's people like that left in this world.
Kelly Carroll knows the impact illness can have on a family. She has a respiratory condition in which her lungs can collapse with little warning. She spent months at a time in the hospital.
It touches home for me because there's been so many times my family didn't know if I was going to make it. So the fact that I did, I want to be able to embrace her.
Because you know where she is.
Yeah, and I made a promise to myself that as long as I have breath, if I can impact my volunteers where they'll be driven by what they saw me do, by precept and example, and that they'll carry on the legacy the way I am for my grandma.
A legacy of charity on a personal but significant scale. For the World Vision Report, I'm Kathy Ducharme in Seattle.
I had something, made me walk all night, made me run from home, made me fight. I had something, made me feel alone, like an orphan waiting for a home. Every footstep
Kelsey Timmerman is a freelance writer from Ohio, but you never quite know where you'll find him. About a year ago, Kelsey got a crazy idea that started him on a journey around the world. He wanted to track down where his clothes came from. We spoke to Kelsey on a rather poor phone line while he was on his travels.
It kind of all started with one t-shirt. It was my favorite t-shirt for a couple years. It was orange, had a tattoo from Fantasy Island on it. And around Tattoo's head, it said, "Follow me to my tropical paradise." So I kind of wondered, well, Tattoo, you know, where is this tropical paradise of yours? You know, I'm from Ohio, and we have long winters, so tropical paradises always sound nice. Looked at the tag, and it was made in Honduras.
And you just decide to pack up and go to Honduras?
That's what I did.
To find out what?
Well, I just kind of wanted to find out where my shirt was made and just to learn who is actually making this t-shirt. So I just want to learn about his life. And, you know, in the USA now, we really hardly make anything. And I think too often we just put on our t-shirt, pull on our jeans, and we don't actually think about where our stuff comes from. And, you know, I think we should at least know something about those places and about those people.
So how do you do that?
All I did was I called the clothing company and I asked them, hey, you know, I want to go to Honduras to find the location where my t-shirt was made and kind of the address. And after laughing a little bit, they gave it to me and off I went.
Yeah, and so what did you discover there?
They were kind of, when I told them what I was doing there, I was just brutally honest. My t-shirt was made here, and I'd kind of like to look around. And they weren't having too much of that, and I eventually got with their PR person. And she basically was stonewalling me. She wouldn't even answer the most simple question I could ask her. I could ask her, how many people does it take to make this t-shirt? And she would just look at me.
Well, it's not hard to understand why she'd be stonewalling, isn't it? I mean, who would believe somebody walking up and say, you know, I came all the way from the United States just to see where my t-shirt was made?
Yeah, I don't blame her at all. I don't blame her. I wouldn't even let me in the door, you know?
So Kelsey, you didn't get everything you wanted in Honduras. You made your way back to the U.S., and instead of having gotten this out of your system, you decided to track down the origins of the rest of your clothes.
That is correct.
So what came next?
Well, what came next was my underwear. They're Christmas boxers, and they have these Christmas ornaments all over them. And they were made in Bangladesh, so that's where I'm talking to you from right now.
What have you learned since you've been in Bangladesh?
You know, it is the world's most densely populated country, and I believe it. And, you know, the people of Bangladesh are so nice and accommodating, so welcoming. Everyone wants me to stop for tea. I could drink 30 cups of tea a day, and everyone wants to bring me home and feed me. So it's not hard at all to make friends in Bangladesh.
Have you found the factory where your underwear was made?
I did.
What did this factory look like?
Well, from the outside, it was just a concrete building, and the conditions aren't that bad, but what is really bad is their pay. Some people get like 10 cents an hour, which equates to about $6 a week.
That's why your t-shirt is so cheap.
Yeah, it is.
And did you ever go home with any of these workers, Kelsey? Did you find out how they live?
Yes, I did. I met this whole building of garment workers that work in the city. And the building itself, I mean, it was really bad living conditions. You know, the smell, as soon as you walk in, is just awful. You just can't describe it. You feel it before you smell it in your nose. And the building itself looked like it had been gutted by a fire. And one particular lady I met, her name was Arifa, and she makes that minimum 10 cents per hour. You know, she has a daughter. Her daughter's around 4. And she lives in a room, 7 foot by 12 foot, with 6 other women who are also garment workers. So life is not great for these people.
Kelsey, has this surprised you or discouraged you in any way?
Well, I guess the lack of pay has surprised me. I knew that the people that made our clothes didn't get paid that much, but I figured that maybe their pay for living in Bangladesh was still maybe livable. But, you know, making $6 a week, it's not going to cut it. You're not going to be able to send your kids to school and improve their situation in life at all.
So I want to ask you, Kelsey, you followed your t-shirt, you followed your boxer shorts. What's next?
Well, next, my All-American blue jeans were made in Cambodia. So in a couple days, I will be heading to Phnom Penh, and we'll start the search for my blue jeans.
Well, Kelsey, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. I really look forward to talking to you again.
Modern textile workers make cloth from cotton, linen, and other fibers. But Peter Kabogazab makes cloth from the bark of trees. He's one of the few craftsmen in Uganda who still knows how. For centuries, bark cloth was considered the only fabric fit for kings. Now this ancient craft is dying, thanks to the influence of Western fashion and the influx of secondhand clothes. Prue Clark brings us this report from Sangwa, Uganda.
An old man sits under the shade of a mango tree, pounding a small wooden mallet. His target, fleshy strips of tender white tree bark. He beats them together until their fibres form a tight web. 78-year-old Peter Kabogozar says it'll take a day to beat together enough strips to form a large square cloth. Kabogozar, a talkative man with a round head and a peculiar resemblance to Mr. Magoo, explains after several days drying in the sun, the cloth will turn a rich terracotta colour.
I learned the craft from my father, who learned it from his father. I don't know who was the first to take up the trade. My family has been making cloth like this and dressing the kabaka for generation after generation.
Kabaka is the ancient name for kings in this region. There was a time when people here wore toga-like garments made from bark cloth for formal ceremonies. But the kabakas, whose splendor was renowned, wore bark clothes no matter what the occasion. This area along Lake Victoria was home to a thriving bark cloth industry until Arab traders arrived in the 19th century with cotton. Gradually, the new fibre won out. Common people stopped wearing it altogether. Only the kabaka held on to the tradition. But today, members of royalty only don the bark cloth on formal occasions. Fewer than 100 bark cloth makers are left in the entire country. Kabukazar lives in a windowless three-room cement block hut with one of his several wives and the youngest of his 25 children. He sits at a wooden table and proudly shows off a finished cloth. It's thick and stiff, like a heavy starch linen, and a little scratchy. It's not hard to see how cotton one converts for clothing. Under the equatorial sun, bark cloth must be hot. But as a craft, it's stunning. Kabukazar begins a garment out here, in the half-acre yard behind his house. He grows a dozen ficus trees, each about 6 inches in circumference. Lush banana trees growing between them provide shade. With a small knife, he peels off the outside layer of bark of one of the ficuses to reveal soft, pale fibres underneath.
I cut the strips from this young wet bark and then wrap the tree in plastic so that the bark will regrow.
Kabukazar checks the bark regrowing under the blue plastic wrapping his trees. Cloth making, he says, shaking his head, can no longer support a family. His 12 sons have moved away to bigger towns to sell phones or drive minibuses, jobs that weren't around in Kabukazar's day.
I'll be very, very sad to see this family's skill die with me. This cloth is part of our people's culture, but it's very hard to make money.
On the outskirts of Kampala, one man is leading an effort to revive the craft, but with a different use.
I paint bark. I use bark as a canvas.
Sena Gacha is one of Uganda's leading painters. His work sells around the world. His vibrantly coloured paintings sit on easels around his gallery in a leafy yard. Gacha's style is as unique as his canvas. He starts with a large panel of bark cloth and uses a natural fibre to outline geometric patterns.
I use a thread, or raffia thread, as a line drawing. And then I use wax to preserve the colour. Then I will apply different colours at the end to give the image a pronouncement.
The end result is a chunky three-layered tapestry painted over with brightly coloured patterns, Picasso style. When Gacha took up painting as a child, the only thing he could find to use as canvas was the bark cloth made by a neighbour.
I'm a self-taught painter, so I found bark cloth closer to me to start off, and I've been with it ever since.
Gacha's also working with local fashion designers to make modern bark clothes, but they're lined with other material to make them more comfortable. Gacha's hoping creativity and national pride will spark a new fashion trend among Ugandans.
I think in a little way we keep it alive.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Prue Clark in Sangwa, Uganda.
In some cultures, cows are considered sacred. In Sudan, camels are held in high esteem and have been for centuries. Gretchen Wilson brings us this portrait of camel traders.
All along this street, women lean over kerosene grills, cooking camel meat, a staple food here. Walk around the corner and you'll find the source of that meat. This is one of the biggest live camel markets in Africa. More than 100 camels are here today. In this corral made of barbed wire fencing, about 24 camels mill around. Their front legs are tied together to prevent them from running off, so they can only take baby steps. Mujadid Alibed Hamid is cajoling one of his camels to sit down. Mohammed's been a camel trader for the majority of his 60-odd years, like his great-great-great-grandfathers before him. Dressed in the long white gown, turban, and sandals that are conventional here, he says he's proud of his herd.
The camels here are the best camels. There's no need to import others for crossbreeding.
His top camels sell for hundreds of dollars. Some will be exported as far away as Egypt and Saudi Arabia. Hamid shows off the cell phone he uses to make deals. The phone may make him a modern man, but in other ways, he sticks to a traditional way of life.
We have inherited this way of life from our grandfathers in ancient times. From the time of the Prophet, peace be upon him, people have been trading camels. Today, camels are still revered for their food and milk and for transportation. That's why we refer to the camel as the ship of the desert.
For most of the year, Hamid takes his small herd on long journeys across Sudan. He rides camelback, of course, along well-worn migration routes in Darfur. Violence has ebbed and flowed there in the past 4 years. But Darfur is bigger than the state of Montana, so camel traders move through the calmer areas. Still, they're sometimes under threat.
Generally, there's been peace and it's improved. But in some areas, there have been difficulties, for example, with stealing and raids on the camel herds.
Hamid says he's been lucky. But he does have to watch out for ornery male camels that sometimes get hostile and spit. Camel milk is rich in fat and protein, and everyone here drinks it fresh. Milking the camels is the job of Hamid's apprentices. Hamid's sons and nephews will continue in his family's trade. It's honorable work, and in one of the world's least developed countries, it's one way to live above abject poverty. For the World Vision Report, I'm Gretchen Wilson in Omdurman, Sudan.
That's our show for this week. Remember, you can hear us anytime on the web at worldvisionreport.org. You can also download a podcast of the show and take us with you. Our team includes Mark Bandy, Chris Baldiga, Cynthia Graber, and Lita Hartman. Melissa Beckett is our intern. And I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.